for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Virginia, thank you for tuning in to WPFW on 89.3. This is Taking Action, Empower DC's radio show, where we talk about all the current issues in DC. And today I've got a recording of an interview I did with a fantastic scholar, Dr. Tanya Golosh-Boza. Dr. Tanya Golosh-Boza is the executive director of the University of California Washington Center. The acronym for that is UCDC, for those that are curious. Tanya Golosh-Boza was appointed by the University of California Office of the President as the third executive director of the University of California Washington program in October of 2022. She is a DC native and a professor of sociology at UC Merced. And Dr. Golosh-Boza joined me for a conversation about her book, Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap and How DC has Changed Over the Years. Before I play the interview, I want to make sure that folks understand that we talk a lot about particular communities. I think Petworth, communities like Navy Yard, Berry Farm, Chevy Chase, they come up a lot. And the conversation that we had was really rich, where we tried to really weave in some of the personal histories of not just Dr. Golosh-Boza, but of the people that lived in these communities and in turn how communities developed over time. And really what we did, I think, is sort of laid clear and bare that the city developed over the course of maybe the last 50 years in a way that has really been centered around gentrifying neighborhoods. And so with that, I hope you all enjoy, and we'll open the phone lines a little later for folks to come in and comment.
Much for joining me, Dr. Tanya Golosh-Boza. Wonderful to have you. I'm wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about how you got to a place where you were writing Before Gentrification.
Yeah, hi, it's great to be here. I think there's many possible origin stories that we could describe for the book in particular, but the one that comes to mind at the moment is almost about 12 years ago. I was in DC visiting because I was living in California at the time for a conference, and I was downtown by the convention center, and my brother was working at a bar on Florida Avenue, right there, like by 7th in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I was going to meet him at the bar after work, you know, after the conference was over. And, you know, it was in the winter time, so it was around 7:30 and it was getting dark. So, I called my brother and I was like, I'm thinking of coming up there. It's about a mile walk. Is it safe? And he laughed. he's like, oh yeah, it's totally changed. So I walked from the convention center up to Florida Avenue, and I just had these like mixed feelings, because it was a lot nicer than I had remembered. Like everything was remodeled, the streets were clean. I remember, you know, passing by a gas station that just back in the 80s, if you go there, you'd have to be super careful, super prudent of your surroundings. And I just had mixed feelings, because on the one hand, I, as a white woman, felt very safe, but also there were no people. Like the people that used to hang out on the corner, you know, doing their thing, they were just all gone. So I was just asking myself, like, you know, it is nice to be able to walk from the convention center to Florida Avenue and feel, you know, perfectly safe in the early evening. But at what cost? Like, what's the human cost of this? Like, okay, I feel safe, but what happened to all the guys that used to hang out here on the corner? What happened to all the small businesses that used to be here? You know, the Black-owned small businesses. So it's like this just mixed feeling of, yeah, like what, what happened? And I definitely had just had feelings about it. Just say like it's a complex topic and I had mixed emotions.
Mm. So as you're sort of walking, it's an interesting sort of like moment where it sounds like maybe you've been sort of transported back into your childhood and sort of recalling what DC used to be at the time. I'm wondering, you know, because I sort of, as a historian, as a practitioner, sort of grapple with the term gentrification. I'm wondering if you can define that for us and then sort of talk about how there's been displacement without gentrification sort of being the explicit term prior to that.
Yeah, so gentrification comes from the word gentry, which means like upper middle class people, usually like landed gentry, people that own homes. But it basically just means middle class people, the gentry, moving into a low income neighborhood. And because of the way cities are organized, low income neighborhoods tend to be disinvested. So it's usually accompanied by some reinvestment. So it's upper middle class people moving into a neighborhood and new investments coming into the neighborhood. So if you if you think about it, it doesn't sound terrible, right? Like having middle class people move into a neighborhood, having money invest into the neighborhood, that doesn't sound bad. You know, there's all kinds of reasons to want economic integration, right? To want middle class people, working class people to live in the same neighborhoods, to therefore have access to the same resources and to fight together for the same resources. But the reason why gentrification tends to be controversial is because when middle class people move into a low income neighborhood, first of all, they tend to have more resources and power, and then tend to advocate for things that they want, you know, that they want in order to make the neighborhood more suitable to them. And also they, once they move in, the neighborhood then becomes more appealing to other middle class people. So then the prices rise, right? And oftentimes it can be more of an orchestrated process whereby the city engages in agreements with developers and promises them, you know, like there's certain ways, certain things you can do to make property values increase in the neighborhood. And therefore, and then the neighborhood becomes unaffordable for long-term low-income residents. So that's gentrification just means middle-class people moving into a low-income neighborhood.
Yeah, and I think that the connotation that gentrification has sort of garnered over the years is that there's a racial component to it, I think, is oftentimes how we interpret it. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the term gentrification doesn't have any necessary racial implications, but in the United States, it almost always has racial implications, partly because race and class are so melded in the US, whereas there are, of course, in DC, there are many upper income Black neighborhoods, but in DC in particular, there has not been a working class white neighborhood since white people moved out of the Anacostia in the 1960s. So DC just did it. So there were no working class white neighborhoods to be gentrified in DC, period. Now that's not the case in other cities. Philadelphia and Baltimore did have white working class neighborhoods that became gentrified. So the racial dynamics were different. But in DC, if you were gonna gentrify a neighborhood since the 1970s, it pretty much was gonna be most likely a majority Black neighborhood, although there were a couple of neighborhoods that had a plurality of Latinos that have also been gentrified.
Mm. That's interesting. One, the sort of historical note that you brought up, because I think it's important that a lot of people don't realize it, that Anacostia used to be this poor working class white community. It's jarring to a lot of people, especially when they sort of think about Anacostia now. Right. It's sort of turned on its head. And I think now we're sort of starting to see the gentrification coming to the Anacostia and east of the river more broadly. I'm wondering if you can paint a picture for us of, I guess, DC before gentrification. Like, what are we looking at as a city? Right. Of course, there's Black enclaves like Georgetown, Berry Farm. But what does the city really look like?
Yeah, and I'll just tell you another story, just because I'm going back to the origin of the book. You know, another time I was in D.C. and I was on 14th Street, like around 14th and R. And I was sitting at a restaurant and I asked the guy that was working there, I was like, how long have y'all been open? And he was like, oh, we've been here 7 years. We were one of the first. And just that, like that narrative that that there was nothing on 14th Street. I mean, we were like next to the Black Cat and two blocks out of U Street, which has a ton of venues on it. But that idea that there was nothing in DC before gentrifiers came is another reason why I wrote the book. So it's such a good question to ask, like, what was DC like before gentrification, or really before this current wave of gentrification? Because there have been previous waves, but this current wave is way more encompassing than other waves. So DC, we just go back to the late 20th century, because we can go back further if we need to. But for now, just to answer that, like, what was it like?
Equal Portions is delighted to join Jazz and Justice Radio, WPFW, every Monday at 1 p.m. beginning August 5th. We're talking everything food justice, interviewing folks across all sectors, and playing the hottest new DMV music with your host, Sasha Lamira.
Hey, y'all. On Equal Portions, we'll be discussing all aspects of the way we interact with food, from the problems affecting our communities to the history and the story of the food around us and the local individuals within the food community. That's Equal Portions. Mondays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Brazilian music is back in its righteous place on WPFW. I'm your host, Roberto, and Berimbau airs on Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. Are you ready to take a trip from Rio Grande do Sul to Amazon and back? That's Berimbau, Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
System was 99% Black. So what happened in D.C. is, as the public services almost exclusively served Black people, those same services became severely underfunded. So we had this situation where even upper middle class Black neighborhoods didn't have a lot of resources, like the schools. You know, if you were living in an upper middle class Black neighborhood and sent your kids to the local public school, the school would be underfunded. There'd be a lot of issues. So there's lots of issues in DC, lots of underfunding, lots of disinvestment. Streetlights wouldn't work. There were potholes. I know there's still potholes, but there were more potholes, I think, back then. But at the same time, DC had, as it was known as Chocolate City, it had an extremely vibrant cultural scene. So one of the things that I think about growing up in DC in the 80s and 90s is the fact that we literally could go to the Go-Go to see live music almost any night of the week. And it was affordable. Like, I mean, it was usually ladies get in free before 10 anyway, but even if you had to pay, it was like $5 or $10. So the fact that as a high school student, we could go to see live music like Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, just all the time. So that like rich culture was super important and super formative for me. Also, DC, you know, was very interested in our fashion at the time. So, you know, it developed its own sense of style. We had our own looks and really prided ourselves on being, you know, DC with our DC looks. And DC had a really strong identity as a city. So I think when we think about what's been lost in DC, and there's a lot of nostalgia for the 80s and 90s, it's because the cultural side of the equation was significant, right? Like people were very strongly identified and continue to be. There's lots of, if you're interested in DC culture in the 80s and 90s, there's Instagram accounts purely dedicated to that, and just the comments and the community that, you know, people really celebrate. So just the hairstyles, the earrings, the outfits, the shoes, just like there was a real strong cultural element to that, and pride and being from DC, and like not even being from Maryland or Virginia, but like from DC. And that, and I think that is something else that's really formative for a lot of us that grew up during that time. And it's not the same. It's not the same anymore.
So at some point I am going to have us go back further than the 20th century, just because mm-hmm. I think that's a very interesting period of history. But when does that start to change, right? And then I guess the other question I have is, like, where would have where would a sort of like middle class black neighborhood have been at the time?
Actually, a lot of neighborhoods were black middle class, and I only realized that by looking at the data. So people will probably disagree with me, but some people. But if you actually look at the census records from 1980, you'll see that most of the neighborhoods, like north of really like the Petworth Metro Station, like most of those neighborhoods moving north were at or above the median income for the city, right? Most of those neighborhoods have pretty low unemployment rates, pretty high employment rates, and pretty high levels of college education, et cetera. So most of those neighborhoods were pretty much middle class, like Petworth, Brightwood, and then they get even wealthier. And Tacoma, and then by the time you get to, you know, the Platinum Coast farther up, Shepherd Park, those were actually upper income, but they kind of like increased in income as they went up the hill. And then, of course, if you wanted to kind of know the history of a neighborhood, you kind of look at the architecture. So those houses around Petworth are kind of small. They're not as small as the houses that get, as you go down into Parkview, the houses get even smaller. So that was more of a low income neighborhood. But as you think about the houses in Petworth, like they're a little bit bigger, and then they get even bigger as they go up, and they also get bigger as you go to 16th Street. So that kind of gives you an indication of like 16th Street Heights was a very solidly upper middle class neighborhood, and then kind of going all the way up 16th Street. And then, so that's Northwest. And then if you go out, you know, Brookland was again middle class. And then going out over by 8th and H, that area, and into Capitol Hill, you know, black middle class neighborhood. And then, of course, those parts of Southeast that are farther out, the Highlands, et cetera, those were all upper. I mean, so DC actually had in 1970, DC and Detroit had the largest percentage of African Americans making over what today in today's dollars would be about $85,000.
That's so interesting because it's so you sort of listed a bunch of different neighborhoods. And the thing that came to mind was that in like the 19th century, like they were like larger swaths of land that were formerly plantations in part. The one that comes to mind is Chevy Chase in particular, and that there's like a thriving black enclave there in Chevy Chase along Broad Branch Road. And you got Fort Greene Park over by Nevada or Nebraska, excuse me. And it's the sort of, I don't know if you'd call this the first wave of gentrification, but it's like private landowners are coming in, and because of racial segregation being explicitly allowed, right? Black people are being barred from homes, and then, you know, eminent domain is used to force them off the land. And that's sort of what creates different little pockets. Like there's another small African-American community in Adams Morgan that sort of forms around like the late 50s and 60s. I'd love it if we could sort of, I guess, go back then and sort of think about what the city looked like in the 20th century too, or in the 19th century rather.
Yeah, or even if we move up to, I mean, I think in the 19th century, the city was very different. Florida Avenue was pretty much the upward bound of the city. And a lot of the neighborhoods that we're familiar with today outside of the central core and outside of Georgetown, of course, were built in the early 20th century. Like, and they kind of go in sequence, like Bloomingdale, Eckington would be like one of the first, and that would be built like in the 1910s, 1920s. And then as you go up, Petworth was mostly built in the 30s and 40s. Farther north, Shepherd Park were built like closer to the 1950s. So there's basically a huge development boom going on in DC in the context of the Second World War, responding to the baby boom and the population explosion, the arrival of people into the city. So all those neighbors are being built in the 1930s and 1940s. And during that time, like in the 1930s, there was legal segregation. So black people were just crowded into the central areas of the city and into a couple of places kind of on the edges of the city in the south and northeast quadrants. So there was severe overcrowding. So back then, even African Americans who had a pretty good salary really couldn't leave those core areas. So they were living in substandard conditions. So then in 1948, the Supreme Court decides that racially restrictive covenants are not legally enforceable. So all of these neighborhoods north of Florida Avenue that had all of these restrictive covenants in that basically said that Black people couldn't buy, rent, or lease those houses, you know, the law had changed. But what is interesting is I found, so I did an in-depth study of one neighborhood called Brightwood Park, which is like around 5th and Kennedy Northwest. Mm-hmm. And I found that there wasn't a big changeover in 1948 or 1949, that it didn't actually happen until around 1954, which is the year of school desegregation. So another big Supreme Court decision came down in 54, which ruled that schools had to desegregate. So there are so many schools in DC that in 1954, so in the 1953-54 school year, they were 100% white. And then in the 1954-55 school year, they were like 100% Black. So the white people just left. Now in Brightwood Park in particular, it took like 3 to 4 years for that school, which was called Rudolph Elementary and is today where Latin sits, the charter school. So that's the elementary school that I went to, Rudolph Elementary. So Rudolph Elementary was 100% white in 1953-54. And then by like 1956, it was 100% Black. So basically the white families in that neighborhood once the school was integrated, they took their kids out of school and they left. And a lot of the departures really happen 54, 55, 56, right? And then they kind of continue, you know, it wasn't like everyone left all at once. It was kind of a slow turnover. But in about by 20 years later, Brightwood Park had gone from 0% Black to 90% Black. So within a generation, pretty much all the white families left. So that neighborhood became majority Black. Now, what happened over in Chevy Chase is the white people didn't leave. And those schools also didn't really integrate. Like Lafayette, Merch, Janney, like they stayed mostly white. So you didn't see the white flight from those neighborhoods, which means that there weren't really that many opportunities for Black people to buy homes in the first place, because the homes were not being offered for sale. And also, of course, the realtors were not taking Black families over there. So there was a lot of kind of Chevy Chase being like kept white, even though, you know, legally Black people could buy homes there. And a couple did, you know, a handful of African-Americans did purchase homes in Chevy Chase, but most of them chose to purchase homes in Petworth and Shepherd Park and other neighborhoods on that side. So that's how Chevy Chase ended up staying majority white, of course, after the eminent domain and the forced removal of African Americans from Broad Branch in the early 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this moment is one that I've been hypothesizing historically for some time, because it's we sort of touched on Southeast Washington, Anacostia in particular, being a poor working white class community. And what stands out to me is this. I always see Anacostia and Chevy Chase as like polar opposites, right? In the 20th century, Chevy Chase is a predominantly white community, and it is rapidly changing in the early part of the 20th century. Anacostia has always been a segregated white community, but with the advent of integration, right, the Southern Switch happens. I like to think of it as Southern Switch in sort of turning the terminology. There's an interesting, just like for folks that are curious, that are listening, you can find like old photos of the Klan in churches in Southeast Washington, right? You can find photos of white children at Anacostia High School chasing Black children out of Southeast Washington. I've spoken with some folk who said that they couldn't walk down Good Hope Road because the white boys would chase them back to Berry Farm, right? And so looking at these two enclaves sort of as polar opposites, the question I have is one, is it that when white flight comes, people are leaving the city altogether? Is there evidence to suggest that some of these folks might be moving into some of the other white enclaves that have been developed over, you know, the last 50-ish years? And then I guess the second question, and this is more like, I don't know if I'm going to call it speculative history, but rather just ask you to engage in that thought process with me of
why is it that the African American communities that have been displaced in areas like Chevy Chase, Reno, Georgetown, why doesn't the infrastructure of like self-sufficiency in the community follow them? Right. It seems to me that the infrastructure of like the local businesses that you mentioned before, like they don't follow them, in particular in that era. And they end up just inheriting the dilapidated infrastructure that has been left behind by white folk that used to live east of the river.
Okay, so I think a lot is going on. First of all, I want to just clarify something I think is really important.
Sure.
So when we think about Petworth in particular, in the Chevy Chase has never been gentrified, right? Like, and I wouldn't call the eminent domain necessarily gentrification, but Chevy Chase was basically a farmland with a couple of enclaves. Those enclaves were destroyed, and Chevy Chase was built as to be an upper middle class white community. Mm-hmm. And with that, it had infrastructure, amenities, resources. It was built with the idea of the well-being of the community in mind, and the imagined community being white upper middle class. Petworth was built with the idea of a white middle class. And then Anacostia was built with the idea of a white working class. I mean, and this is when developers are deciding how big they're going to make the lots and how big they're going to make the houses, it's because they really have an income level in mind. You know, just if you just imagine today, if you wanted to build a development, you'd have to propose, you know, I propose like 1300 square feet and, you know, I propose selling it at this point because you have a community in mind. So this is not conspiracy theory, right? Like they definitely had communities in mind, and realtors really created this idea of white communities because they thought that they would sell more. That was their goal. Like, let's make money by selling this as a white community. So when Petworth was built in the 1930s and 40s, the developers, you know, worked, I'm sure, with the city government to make sure that there were small businesses there. There were theaters. There was the Kennedy Theater and another theater on Georgia Avenue. There were retail shops. There were delis. There were, you know, drug stores where you could get ice cream and also medicine, et cetera. So it was a vibrant, thriving community, just like in Chevy Chase was, although Chevy Chase was more upscale. And Anacostia also had all of these things too, just as a working class white community. But they all three of those communities, if we're thinking about like 1950, they all had significant amenities. And of course, the people that were displaced from the Broad Branch community in Chevy Chase, they were dispersed across the city. So they didn't all go one place. They were displaced multiple times. When white people left Petworth in large numbers between 1954 and 1965, so in about that 10-year period, I'd say most white people left that neighborhood. The neighborhood did not like just immediately decline, right? First of all, a lot of the businesses stayed. The delis were still there. And if you talk to people who lived in Petworth in the 1960s, they tell you that the drugstores were still there. The shops were still there. The delis, all of the small businesses were still there. There's actually Twin Dragon Chinese carryout was there in the 1950s. It's still there today. So there's a couple of, and those funeral homes, a couple of them are the same. Like they were there, the flower shop. So there are businesses that have survived since that time and are still there. What happened in Petworth is that, if you own a deli, right? Like, you know, when you retire from the deli, like, it's not like your son is going to necessarily want to take it over. Like, often people have this dream. And I think that that's happening, you know, like even with that Twin Dragon Chinese carryout, like the children have agreed to take it on, but you know, at some point the kids are like, you know what, I don't want to run a carryout, and then it will close down, right? That is as usually what's going to happen. And then when it closes down, it gets put back on the market, you know, as a business. So I'm pretty sure that's pretty much what happened in Petworth is the owners of a lot of those stores were Jewish. And when you ask me where they went, a lot of them went to Shepherd Park. So some of them went to Montgomery County, like left the city entirely. But a lot of them just moved up to Shepherd Park. And actually, there's a historian, well, she's really an economist, but she started doing a lot of history work of her own neighborhood. North Portal Estates, Felicia Bowman, and she has found, she's done.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break from the recording here for a moment. Just as a reminder, folks, you're tuning to WPFW on 89.3. If you want to call in and have a conversation about what you've heard so far, you can call at 202-588-0893. Again, that's 202-588-0893. This has been a conversation that I had with Professor Dr. Golash Boza. Again, her book, Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap, is the topic of our conversation. And as you've heard so far, we're really getting into a lot of the nitty-gritty of how the city sort of happened to take shape over the last 50 years, really from the 70s on. I will note that just as an aside, the history of the Broad Branch community in Chevy Chase is one that's dynamic and sort of covers a lot of development in the city. For the folks that are familiar with Lafayette Elementary School, that school sits where the Black family used to live. And that family, or two families, really, one of those families goes from Chevy Chase, D.C. to Reno City. It's displaced from Reno City in the 30s and goes to Georgetown. They're priced out of Georgetown as a result of historic preservation efforts. So families lose generational homes because property taxes increase. And then they find their way to Southwest Washington, which undergoes urban renewal. And then they find their way into Berry Farm. And that's the really sort of heartbreaking piece, is that through this one particular family, you can see the city develop and continually be, you know, forcing Black people from place to place to place. As we're about to jump back into the interview, just want to remind folks, the phone number to call in is 202-588-0893. Again, it's 202-588-0893. Dr. Golash Boza is not in the studio with me, but you can have a conversation with me if you feel so inclined. All right, here we go back to the interview.
I'll say this: when I first opened up in the 50s and 60s, we're Jewish and we're from like Petworth, Brentwood. So she's
found evidence. A lot of them have moved up that road.
So they don't necessarily, you know, their kids don't necessarily want to do it. So what happens by the time you get to, so 1950s, 1960s, thriving neighborhood, thriving businesses. 1970s, a lot of these businesses are starting to close because, you know, people that own them are retiring. Their kids don't really want to take it over. But now the neighborhood is over 90% Black. And when a neighborhood is over 90% Black, it gets redlined, which means that banks are no longer willing to loan money in those neighborhoods. So now there's an empty deli because the owner has retired. And so let's say a Black family comes along and says, you know, I want to open a deli there too, or I want to open a restaurant in that same location. They might not get a loan, right, from the bank in order to do it. And actually, my parents owned a house on 4th and Kennedy, and they bought that house in 1976. And then we moved from 4th and Kennedy just up the street, but we moved in, we put that house, my parents put that house on the market in 1983. And they said that 11 people put offers on the home and only to have their loans denied. Mm. Right. So that means that there were 11 Black families who thought that they could purchase that home because they had the resources. And 11 times banks told them, no, you can't, you don't qualify for a mortgage. So that shows you that the neighborhood was redlined. Like, basically just means that there are many Black people that wanted to buy homes, that wanted to start businesses. But if you don't have the capital, and I think another thing that happens is just like racism, where in addition to not giving people loans, it's like, oh, if someone says to the bank, I want to open a carryout on Kennedy Street, the bank would be like, oh yeah, that sounds good. Black people like carryout food, so I'll give you the money for that. But if they said they wanted to open a deli or something that maybe is perceived to not be something that Black people like, then maybe their loans would get denied. Now, I don't know, that's speculative, but all I know is that by the time I was growing up in the 1980s, the only businesses on Kennedy Street were funeral homes, liquor stores, carryouts. And like I said, there was that flower shop that had been there. There was that conservatory that had been there, but new like coffee shops or flower shops didn't open up right in the 80s. And I think the reason is that banks were not willing to give loans to Black people to open certain kinds of businesses in those neighborhoods.
Yeah.
All right. So it looks like we've got a caller. Caller, this is Corey. You are on the air.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. What's your question, brother?
I wanted to talk to her about some things, you know, because what she's saying is, you know, true, but she's leaving out a lot of things, so I guess she just don't know, you know, because her age group is way from mine, you know, because so, I'm 85 years old, and I live in this place all my life.
You live up in Albemarle, off of like up by on like Wisconsin Avenue and things.
Well, Wisconsin Avenue in that area was always pretty much white because didn't have many blacks living over there. But in of course Georgetown was pretty much all black when I was a kid. You know, most of those kids went to Francis Junior High School, then they came over to Dunbar or whatever. See, because my first year of high school, 1954, that's when integration came.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the neighborhoods open up. But like I tell you, I go this way. White schools were Anacostia, Eastern. Mm-hmm. It was a vocation school that I don't think existed when I came when that was white. McKinley, Roosevelt, Coolidge, Wilson, and Weston was all in white schools. The black schools had Dunbar, Armstrong, Cardoza, and Margaret Washington were the Northwest black schools. And then Northeast, you had Spingarn was built, was the last black school built. It was built in the 50s. I was in junior high school when Spingarn was built. I was going to Brown Junior High School and Phelps Vocational High School. So you had Phelps Vocational High School, Spingarn. She had six black schools, and all the rest of them were white. Now, when Spingarn was built, that was filled up mostly by the people that came from Southeast and Burr Farms and places like that in Anacostia, because most of Anacostia was white.
Right.
You go up where they used to have Douglas Junior High School, Promrose Road, and all up in there, where they had Douglas Junior High School. Then if you go, Suitland Parkway wasn't built. So if you go across up Stanton Road, there was a black apartment built called Parkland. That was where the blacks lived. Congress Heights and all that was all white, see, because if you leave Burr Farms, there was some black people live up to the Crazy Sound. Can't say Crazy Sound. Up to St. Elizabeth's. But above St. Elizabeth was all white. All where Nicholas Avenue, where's Martin Luther King now, where turns to Ben over there, where Burr used to live at, all that going down there was white. All that area was white. And then coming back up, going to Alabama Avenue, coming all the way out there was all white. All of Pennsylvania Avenue and Branch Avenue and Alabama Avenue, that was all white.
Yeah.
And
the thing I wanted to note is that it's, I think the point that she's making is that in particular in areas like Anacostia, over by like Fort Davis, where, because I learned not that long ago that Fort Davis and Fort DuPont Park used to be a country club. And they, like all of that where they put like a nice little cul-de-sac and things, it used to be a golf course and a country club. And so I think that the point she's making is that the development that comes, right, to Southeast Washington and really to the rest of the city, what it does is determine where we are today, right? And when we get to this place where, in the 50s, we have, as you've pointed out correctly, right, integration comes, and the schools that used to cater in particular to black children, the one that comes to mind is the Grant Road School that used to be up on Grant Road in Northwest, up by Chevy Chase. because there used to be these little pockets like Fort Reno and Broad Branch, or at the time they called it Dry Meadows, where Black folk used to live. And as Black folk were pushed out, those the Rosenwald schools and things like that, they closed. And so then that's how we get Spingarn, Dunbar, Armstrong, Cordoza, that end up catering predominantly to a Black population.
Yeah, well, see, but Blacks still, you know, like right now they call everything Capitol Hill. I was born on 4th Street between F and G. Mm-hmm. All right, that's about maybe say 2 blocks from Union Station. Well, that was all Black houses in there, and they were nice houses, and mostly it was middle class people living in there all throughout that area. Cause, but then also across the street from me was called 3rd and a half Street. So Blacks lived in the alleys. They call them alleys now, but the Blacks lived in there. They had a lot of, they had 3rd and a half Street, up the street with 4th Street, Gordon's Avenue. They were alleys, but Black people built it in the alleys. So when the white people started moving back to town through this gentrification, they turned all those into carriage houses and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, all out to 15th Street north is Maryland Avenue and all that. A lot of Blacks lived in those houses. They were middle class Blacks lived in those houses.
Yeah.
All through there, and you go up like Kentucky Avenue around Lincoln Park.
Yeah.
A lot of Black people lived all in that area. You know, so there was a lot of middle class Black people. Of course, now they done made everything from the Capitol all the way out to 15th and 8th Capitol Hill now, because that raised the prices on the houses.
I got you. So I got to get back to my interview, but I appreciate you calling, brother.
Okay, my brother. Take care.
You too.
And I think what you described really perfectly is like how our neighborhoods take shape. Right. Mm-hmm. It really is a deliberate set of policies going back that sort of lay out what does and doesn't end up in a particular place. I'm wondering also, there's this interconnected web you sort of described of housing policies that are discriminatory, redlining, racially restrictive covenants. I won't enumerate them all, but I'm also wondering, like, to what degree, right, because racially restrictive covenants are outlawed in the 40s, to what degree then does, like, implicit segregation, apply, right? The sort of internalized, oh, that's where they live, and so we're not even going to bother. Like, how significant is that?
I mean, it's hard to know. It would be hard to design a study to figure out, like, why Black people didn't move to other neighborhoods. But here's what we do know. We know for sure that there were people who actively were interested in helping Black people move to Petworth and Brightwood. So there's if you look at the Neighbors Inc. archives, Neighbors Inc. was an organization set up in the 1950s, and their goal was neighborhood integration. But that means that they mobilized a group of people to actively ensure that Black people could purchase homes in those neighborhoods. And I think if you think about DC, the only there's probably three integrated neighborhoods in the 1990s, Shepherd Park, Mount Pleasant, and Southwest Waterfront. Southwest Waterfront was integrated in a kind of unusual way, but basically you had housing projects adjacent to these condos, and somehow they managed to live peaceably next to each other for a very long time. It's kind of a unique situation. Of course, there's all this violence that preceded that, but what ended up happening is you have public housing adjacent to these condos, and that was an economically and racially integrated neighborhood if you kind of look at it at a larger scale. And then if you look at Mount Pleasant, Adams Morgan, that was an integrated neighborhood. It was the one neighborhood in DC that had a significant Latino population in the 1980s and 1990s. And it was probably and it was also integrated by class and race. But that is due to like active organizing. It's a very heavily organized community. People believe in diversity, believe in rights, believe in the right to housing, et cetera. And then Shepherd Park, which is an upper middle class community that is to this day remains integrated, although maybe even more majority Black than it used to be. And that was due to Neighbors Inc. organizing to keep that neighborhood integrated. So what you see is that in order to create a truly integrated neighborhood, you need people, somebody needs to, there needs to be organizing on the ground in order for that to happen.
Yeah.
Because what was happening otherwise is when Black people, you know, indicated to real estate agents that they wanted to purchase homes, they were steered towards certain neighborhoods. And the realtor just wouldn't take them over to Chevy Chase. Now, you could, of course, say to the realtor, no, I noticed that there was a home for sale on Albemarle Street, and I want to see that home. And the realtor might take you there. And, you know, but then, of course, they might do that reluctantly. And then the homeowner might, you know, give preference to a white family that wants to move in. You know, so like, it's not, none of this is legal, of course, but there's all kinds of barriers being put in your way if you want to purchase a home in Chevy Chase. And then even probably more difficult to purchase a home in the Maryland, in Montgomery County before 1968, because before 1968, the discrimination pretty much was legal and was continuing in Montgomery County. And then if you think about Prince George's County, Prince George's County was also majority white. So people don't often think about the fact that PG County was, when it was first constructed, was majority white. It only became majority Black with the passage of the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which really like made discrimination in housing more illegal than it had been previously and put up a certain amount of protections for home buyers. But then the same thing happened. So Black people who lived in the city moved out to PG County because they wanted those big homes with the yards. Mm-hmm. And white people left, right? They left PG County in very large numbers. So the same thing kind of happened. So it's kind of like that's why integration in that time period only happened with organizing, because either the white people prevented Black people from moving in, or if Black people succeeded in moving in, there's like a tipping point at which the white people are like, okay, we're all leaving. And then they would all leave. So I think that's kind of, that helps me to understand the how segregation persisted.
Beautifully put. I couldn't draw it better myself. I'll say that the only addendum I'll add is that Berry Farm was built in, I think, 1944.
Okay.
And so we had like a couple of decades of like really solid, the stories about Berry Farm is I think everyone I speak to is talking to me about Double Dutch mm-hmm. and dancing in the alleys. And it's such a beautiful gist. And at the same time, it's so difficult to like understand that as the community that it was, and to sort of see it fall into a state of disrepair. There was one other thing I was going to add to that, just as it's one that I add whenever people sort of bring up the crack cocaine era. Is like it's put really well in the Berry Farm Community Land and Justice film about, like, you know, we didn't bring drugs to the country, right? Because we don't have boats.
Yeah.
Right. And we didn't bring the guns either, because we don't have, you know, planes to transport them. Mm-hmm. And for a while I thought about it as like speculative history, but it really isn't, right? You know, Ronald Reagan worked really, really hard to fund two revolutions on either front, one in Nicaragua, one in Iran. And it's open knowledge at this point that the CIA was actively allowing the Nicaraguan Contras, the revolutionary group, to sell crack and cocaine across the U.S. border. They didn't participate in the sale, but they also didn't stop it. And so it's this really bizarre sort of moment where that, with the mix of, as you put it, the investment in the carceral state and disinvestment in communities, that creates this moment for Berry Farm, you know, late 70s, where the community really is just ravaged by like a set of really difficult forces, and they never really had the time and space to recover. Berry Farm is a really difficult community. Now we're hoping to preserve those five buildings that Empower DC was able to sort of get on the site. As we're sort of coming up on time, I'm wondering, what is one thing that you think people should get from your book, Before Gentrification?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why I called it before gentrification is really just a reminder that there was so much here in DC before gentrification, and there's so much worth preserving. And also, like,
I think sometimes when I hear people, they say, oh, look at Navy Yard, it's so pretty. Look, there's kids dancing in the fountains and it's so beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, it is very nice. It is nice to be able to go down to the river and watch the sunset into the river. But some of us look at this neighborhood and remember the bloodshed. And I think what a lot of times we haven't really provided the space for people to process the trauma of the 1980s and 1990s. Like I said, it was definitely a very beautiful period, but it was also a very traumatic period. People that are my age, graduating from high school in the late 80s, early 90s, we watched, you know, our friends get killed, hauled off to prison. And that's traumatic, right? Like, it is traumatic to lose so many people. And it's traumatic to have so many people pull from our communities. And I think sometimes it feels like the city is just trying to move forward without acknowledging or allowing us to process that trauma. So I think on the one hand, we both want to recognize the rich history of DC. We also want to recognize the deep trauma that the city experienced, because we can't just move forward like nothing happened, just build a nice water fountain on the top of like a place where, you know, 25 people were killed in the space of a couple of years. So I think that's another thing that I want people, that I feel like is not talked about enough when we talk about what led to gentrification in DC.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Tanya Golash-Boza, thank you so much for joining us. Where can folks learn a bit more about the book?
Thank you, Corey. Well, Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap is available at most local bookstores, including Loyalty, Politics and Probe, Mahogany Books, and other local bookstores. You also can buy it wherever you buy books online or from the University of California Press website.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Great to chat.
All right.
WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Dr. Theodore Watkins, the program is to your health.
Join Dr. Theodore Watkins on Mondays from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on To Your Health, as he teaches alternative medicine to alleviate illnesses using a holistic approach, bringing important wellness treatment options to the table otherwise overlooked by health officials across a variety of medical fields. Learn how to treat yourself to your best health under the instruction of Dr. Watkins. That's 2 to 3 p.m. on WPFW 89.3 FM, serving the collective need and imagination of the community.
We're going to see you again next week.
The Birchmere welcomes Lady Smith Black Mambazo, Tuesday, July 30th. Nelson Mandela titled them South Africa's cultural ambassadors to the world. Details at birchmere.com.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. California's Park Fire continues to rage today after becoming the fifth largest wildfire in state history and the second biggest in the U.S. this year. According to CAL FIRE, the fire has consumed close to 600 square miles and remains at 14% contained as of this morning. Authorities said the fire started when a man pushed a burning car into a dry ravine near his hometown of Chico. He was officially indicted on felony arson charges yesterday. While arson may have provided the spark to light the blaze, climate change-related factors, including the heat and extreme dryness, have enabled the spread of the park fire. Some areas burned by the park fire saw their single hottest 30-day periods on record just before the blaze broke out. In political news, the 2024 presidential election is now less than 100 days away, and Democrats are still waiting to see whom Vice President Kamala Harris will pick as her running mate. The potential pool is narrowing after Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper announced yesterday they were not in the running. Meanwhile, Harris could become the official nominee when a virtual vote begins as soon as Thursday. This comes after the Democratic National Committee last week finalized the rules for it to consider a virtual nomination roll call ahead of the national convention. By last Monday evening, Harris had already accumulated more than enough delegate support to win the nomination. In international news, thousands of Venezuelans took to the streets last night in downtown Caracas to protest after President Nicolas Maduro claimed victory to a third six-year term in power in a disputed election result. The National Electoral Council, which is loyal to Maduro's ruling party, declared early yesterday that the incumbent president was the winner of Sunday's presidential election and had secured just over half the votes. Last night, opposition leaders said they had collected more than 73% of voting center records and claimed that opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez won twice as many votes as Maduro. Meanwhile, the U.S. and several Latin American countries said that Maduro could not claim victory in Sunday's election without releasing the full vote count. And the World Health Organization and other UN humanitarian agencies called today for a ceasefire in Gaza to facilitate a mass vaccination campaign. Gaza's health ministry declared a polio epidemic across Gaza on Monday after samples of the virus were found in sewage, although no human cases have been reported. A WHO spokesperson told a UN press briefing that people had probably been infected in Gaza, but detecting cases can be difficult since most cases of the potentially deadly viral disease are asymptomatic. In a statement yesterday, Gaza's health ministry said that after many years of eradicating polio, the population faced a dire situation caused by Israel's military offensive in Gaza, quote, which has deprived residents of safe drinking water, destroyed sewage infrastructure, accumulated thousands of tons of garbage, caused food insecurity, and crowded residents.